be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again on truth2u.org. That's truth number two, letter u.org. It's season two of Torah Pearls and blah. Hang on. I don't know why.
There's only 9 a.m. There's only 9 o'clock on your watch, right? And it's the one that happens in the evening.
Yeah, that's right. 9 a.m. in the morning is like, it may as well be 5 in the morning. And that's what Jason's got me up doing all the way from Ireland. Gets me up at 9 in the morning. Everyone's going 9 in the morning. That's like, you know, I've already done 3 hours work. But yeah, but, you know, some of us are night watchmen, you know?
Yeah, that's right. Sorry. some of us are watchmen on the walls.
Yeah, watchmen on the wall at night.
That's right.
At night. We stay up at night. I don't think those guys be getting up early in the morning, right?
And,
you know. Nah, I don't think so. Anyway, Ireland. Ireland. How is it in Ireland where it's, what, 10 p.m.?
It's dark. That's all I have to tell you.
All right. Done. That's good. I'm still waiting for my coffee to kick in. And while I do, Russ Nichols of RootsOfFaith.org from Louisiana, where it's a comfortable 5 p.m. in ancient truth for a modern world. G'day, mate.
Good day. Good day, guys. So glad to be here. It's 5 o'clock. I'm glad that both of you took the bad hours, early morning, late night, and here I am, 5 p.m. How did I get the privilege of that?
Because you're the special one.
Sorry, when we get to Israel, it'll be Ross that's going to do all the babysitting.
Yeah.
That's right.
And, of course, we are going to Israel. We're going to Israel in November, dear listeners. And, I'll get up early when I'm in Israel, and I'll be happening. Don't worry about it. But we're going to be there. We're going to be there with Tobias Singer. We're going to be traveling all around Israel. It's going to be awesome. There's still seats available on the bus, people. There's still seats, but they're going. So don't leave it too long. You can sign up and come with us. We would love you to come with us. Go to truth2u.org and just follow the links. Looking forward to that. Hey, at least I'm squeaky clean. With you know that, why?
You have soap.
I've got really, really good soap. Thank you to Sarah for the soap from Handcrafted Natural Soaps. People can find, in fact, I'm going to put a link. I'm going to put a link on this post because really, this is the best soaps I've ever used. I'm not going to, you know, do a song and dance about a soap because,
well,
I don't
like
think grown men
should. Like a soap opera.
Yeah, I'm not going to do a soap opera. It's not the kind of thing that grown men do.
You're not going to stand on a soapbox and talk about it.
I'm not.
Hey, I use that soap as well. So, you know, that might be a selling point for the tour. Can you imagine going on a tour with guys that smell like us? I mean, this is...
It's awesome soap.
Well, I happen to have a little bit of an inside track that everyone that's on the tour is going to get a very special limited edition soap.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I'm serious. I'm not at liberty to divulge anything else, but that's going to happen.
Oh, okay. It's worth it just for that. I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
No, just, all right. Now, I'm not going to, men, soap clean, good. That's all I'm going to say. But my wife, Hani, she said this, we're using the spearmint, and she said, I love, love, love this soap. This is my favorite so far. Spearmint soap, boys and girls. What are your wives? Which soap are you using?
I'm using the same soap. I started with the frankincense and myrrh. I've moved to the spearmint bar. And, you know, on mine, she puts this stamp of the Hebrew letter sheen. Do you have that on yours?
Yeah, I've got that. Yeah. Yep.
Ah, isn't that nice?
I got tea tree oil is my favorite at the moment, but I have coming to me this week a new soap that we worked on together. There's like a collaboration.
Are you serious?
So, and it's called Samson soap. So I've got one coming. I'm gonna try it out, see what it's like. And then she's allowing me to make up the label for it, like the wrapper, and then there'll be a brand new product.
This sounds more like something that guys can talk about. Samson soap.
I like
Samson
that. Soap. Yeah.
Mm. Soap, clean, good. Mm.
For the tough jobs.
For the tough jobs. There you go. Done. Like it. All right. Let's talk about that when it comes through. Mm. Where are we today? We're in Sav. This is, we're in Leviticus. Vayikra is where we are.
Hey, wait. Yeah. Happy New Year, guys.
Oh, same to you.
Hey, Happy New Year.
I mean, what do you... You can't just start off like this without saying Happy New Year to folks. I mean, Exodus 12:1-2 says this is the beginning of months. We are in a new year, so Happy New Year to all the listeners.
Thank you, Ross. Thank you very much. That's exactly where we are. And so we're now in Leviticus. We haven't done Torah Pearls with you, Ross, since we were in Exodus. But here we are in Leviticus chapter 6, verse 1. We're going all the way to chapter 8, verse 36. And there's a, again, we're in one that has a lot of repetition. This kind of, I mean, last week, Jason, we talked about the law. We talked about the burnt offering, the grain offering, the sin offering, the trespass offering, the peace offering. This Torah portion has the law of the burnt offering, the law of the grain offering, the law of the sin offering. What's the difference between last week's Torah portion and this week's Torah portion?
I think last week's was, if you like, a bullet point. And this one's going to go into a little bit more information, and especially how that pertains to the priests.
So you're exactly right.
We're unfolding it a bit more this week.
You hit it dead on, Jason. It's in chapters 1 through 5, beginning in verse 1, chapter 1, verse 2, it says it's to all of Israel, whereas here in this Torah portion in Sav, in chapter 6, verse 2, they're told to address this to the priest, to Aaron and his sons. So it's a little more specific this week pertaining to the priest, whereas in chapters 1 through 5, it was sort of an announcement to all of Israel about these sacrifices.
Something else that's really cool about this is, we're really used to using the word Torah and to mean the five books of Moses, but there are lots of Torahs in this, just in this Torah portion. Whenever you see the word law come up, it's almost always going to be Torah. So for people that are new to this, maybe it's their first time going through the Tanakh and the first time going through the Torah portions. Torah literally means directions or instructions or law or commandment, but really it's a guidance. So whenever you see the word law, you can put that down as instruction. It's a much nicer way of saying it, I think. I think law sounds a little bit too kind of concrete. So when we read the law of the burnt offering, the law of this, the law of that, we're looking at Torah. And the Torah itself is full of Torahs.
That's right. Every one of these sacrifices is introduced. I just flipped ahead as you made that comment, Jason. It literally, each section begins with the phrase in Hebrew, so Torah, this is the instruction of. So that's a great point. Yeah, Torah doesn't always mean the five books of Moses, Genesis 1 through Exodus, or through Deuteronomy 34.
So we have the first five verses, at least. This is the law of the burnt offering. Let's see if we can move through and just highlight that which should be highlighted. Is there anything there in the law of the burnt offering that anyone wants to pick up on?
This idea in verses 5 and 6 where it talks about a continual fire. You know, that phrase, continual fire, there's quite a bit in there that we can talk about. If we have a minute, we'll just kind of talk about the, in Hebrew, it's Esh Tamid. The Esh Tamid, the word Tamid, I love that word in Hebrew. It's used 103 times in Scripture, and it's sometimes translated continual. I don't know what your translation says.
Well, I've got, in verse 13, it says, a fire shall always be burning on the altar. It shall never go out.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a continual fire. One of the things, sort of to bring us back to this idea of going to Israel, let me tie this into our Israel trip. Let's do that. You want to?
Please.
What is the one thing, I'm talking about the word Tamid, what is the one thing that we see God doing continually in the Hebrew Scriptures, that he says, I'll do this all the time? Deuteronomy 11, verse 12.
A land for which the Lord your God cares always, the eyes of the Lord your God are always on it, from the beginning of the year to the very end of the year.
Now, in Hebrew, where it says always, it's the word tamid. And so I just wanted to tie that in because it's also appropriate because beginning at the beginning of the year, and this is where we are, from the beginning of the year to the end of the year, his eyes are always on this land.
There's a couple of interesting points that, especially one in particular that were nulled over. But just quickly, if we're going to run through the areas of this, this instance of a continual fire was the only instance in the whole of your Tanakh where you're going to find that it's okay pretty much to ignore a direct commandment. So we read that you shan't kindle a fire on Shabbat, but that didn't apply to the sanctuary. So that fire had to be kept going regardless. Mm-hmm. What that led me to in my mind is last week we spoke a lot in last week's Torah portion about Jesus being the Lamb of God. And is there an example of a male lamb coming up as a sin offering in the Torah? And this week is
Well, I was going to say, this last week's Torah portion came up with a blank, right? Are we going to find it in this one?
Well, what kind of struck me as I was reading this is this was a continual fire. And then I thought to myself, it's a continual fire, but the sacrifices on it weren't continual. There's no one big payoff of a sacrifice that from there on mattered. You know, if it is, even if it was annually, that they still had to renew that sacrifice. The fire was consistent, but the sacrifice wasn't. So even if we do find a lamb, which we know we won't, spoiler alert, but we're not going to find a male lamb who had to be beaten to within an inch of its life and offered outside the city by pagans. That's not going to happen. But even if we did, we won't find a sacrifice that one time it happened counts for everybody forever for everything. But the fire does, and I thought that was kind of cool. It's a consistent, continual fire. But there's a law. Most people apply it to an axe. In England, it's called Trigger's Broom. Anyone in England who's watching might know Trigger from a show called Only Fools and Horses. And in Only Fools and Horses, there's a character called Trigger, and he's not too clever. And he's in a cafe one day, and he's got this broom. And this guy says to him, how long have you had that broom? He said, oh, this is my granddad's broom. He says, really? And he goes, yeah, this broom's been in my family for 70 years. He goes, you know, occasionally we have to replace the head, and occasionally we have to replace the handle, but the broom we've had for 70 years. And it's kind of that way with the fire. You know, although the fire is a constant, eternal fire, they have to replace the wood, and the ashes get changed all the time. So the fire components change, but the fire is continual. And I thought that was kind of interesting things to think about.
Yes. Yeah, in the Torah in Exodus 35:3, that's the passage you were talking about, Jason. I also had that marked. You know, that it's interesting that this is an exception to that rule, if you will, that you're not to ignite a fire on Shabbat, and yet this fire is to continually burn. In fact, there, you know, one of the things that I think about when we talk about indistinguishable or inextinguishable fires in the Torah, you have two. One is referred to as the Ner Tamid, which is the lamp that burns all the time to provide light. And then we have this this fire, the Esh Tamid, the fire of the altar.
The altar for the incense, that's not burning all the time. That's something that's only used in specific occasions. Is that right?
I'm not sure.
That's a great question. I don't think that is burning all the time.
I don't think it is. But I'm not 100% sure. That's probably one to throw out to the listeners. We'd love to hear back from you on that one. Ross?
Yeah, one other thing. In Deuteronomy 33:2, there's this interesting passage. Let me open it up. It says in Deuteronomy 33:2, he said, Jehovah came from Sinai and dawned from Seir upon us. He shone forth from Mount Paran. He came from the 10,000s of holy ones with flaming fire at his right hand. In Hebrew, it's Eshdat, which some translations have a fire law. So the idea of the testimony being a fire law in the hand of Jehovah is an interesting point. We're talking about fire. Yeah. One other thing, have you read Tabor's book, Restoring Abrahamic Faith?
I've read it twice. Mm. Brilliant book. I love the book. While we're talking about it, highly recommend everybody get a copy. It's just one of those books. Where can they get it, Ross?
You can get it on his website at genesis2000.org, genesis2000.org. There's an interesting thing when we talk about this continual fire. If you go to Daniel chapter 8, it's in context. We're talking about this vision, the little horn, and so forth. Beginning in verse 11, it became great, even as great as the prince of the host, and the regular burnt offering was taken away from him. The place of his sanctuary was overthrown. A host will be given over to it together with the regular burnt offering because of transgression. It will throw truth to the ground. It will act and prosper. Then I heard a holy one speaking. Another holy one said to the one who spoke, for how long is the vision concerning the regular burnt offering, the transgression that makes desolate, and the giving over the sanctuary and host to be trampled underfoot? And he said to me, for 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the sanctuary shall be restored to its rightful state. In his book, Restoring Abrahamic Faith, he reports this interesting commentary written in 1825 by a Methodist minister by the name of Adam Clark. And in Adam Clark's commentary, he was looking at this text trying to determine when this prophecy would be fulfilled and the 2300 days or evenings and mornings would be completed. In other words, when would the sanctuary be vindicated? And what he says is that Adam Clark calculated from 334 BCE, from the time when Alexander the Great entered into this area, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he calculated forward, and he missed it by 1 year because he neglected to add the extra year. There's no zero year. So if you go from 334 BCE and you add 2,300 years, you come up to 1967. Now, he goes further in his book, and he shows that the date, which is recorded as Artemisius the 28th on the Olympiad calendar, guess what date that is? June the 7th. So if you go from June the 7th, 334 BCE, you count 2,300 years, literally to the day, and you come up to June the 7th, 1967. That's the date. To the day, not only to the year, but to the date that the Jewish people regained control of the Temple Mount.
That's pretty awesome.
How about that? That is pretty awesome.
That's compelling. How about that? So, once again, restoring Abrahamic faith. Dr. James Tabor. Jason.
We did an interview with Dr. Tabor on this, so you can find that on Truth to You, specifically about that book.
I'll put a link.
Do it.
Done. So the next passage deals with the law of the grain offering. Anything to highlight, Jason?
There's a couple of cool things on here. Verse 8, it says his handful. So often when we find there are sacrifices, the only variant in what is brought is maybe the size of the animal that you're bringing. But in this, it's the priest's handful is the measure. So they're not asking for a cup or a half a cup of grain. It's literally the handful of the priest, and each priest has a different size hands. And so to make it easier for everybody, it's just that the priest's handful. And I thought that was kind of smart. The other thing worth looking at here is that they eat the bread unleavened. And that was a nice inclusion there. We often imagine that they go off and make these amazing loaves. But in this particular instance, it's without leaven.
Now, I should just point out, in case people are, because you just said verse 8, you're reading from the Tanakh, right?
Oh, yeah, I am. Sorry. Yeah, so the Christian Bible is going to be slightly different, I think.
Yeah, so the Christian Bible. So if, just in case you're getting confused with the verses, the numbering of the verses, a Christian Bible is numbered slightly differently. The verses are different than that in the Tanakh. Anything to add there, Ross?
Yeah, just on that point you just made, that all the verse variations do iron themselves out between the English and the Hebrew once we get to chapter 7. But it's this chapter 6 is going to be a 4 or 5 verse difference. But one other thing, in verse 11, there's this idea that holiness is contagious. Let me look at it in...
So I've got in verse 18 in the Christian Bible, it says, all the males among the children of Aaron may eat it. It shall be a statute forever in your generations concerning the offerings made by fire to the Lord. Everyone who touches them must be holy.
Yeah, and it's also, this idea is found in verse 20 of chapter 6. And also, I'll just read one passage, one verse from Exodus 29:37. Mm-hmm. It says, 7 days you shall make atonement for the altar and consecrate it, and the altar shall be most holy. Whatever touches the altar shall become holy. So this idea occurs several times in the Torah, and I think it's very interesting that, you know, just as we think of sin as being contagious or defilement, holiness also can spread. So I like that idea.
Oh, so it's worth mentioning that in mine, verse 13 starts in the day when he is anointed. That's not really a Hebrew idiom, but what it does mean is that from the day he is anointed. That actually comes up a few times through the Torah portion. So if you see the words in the day when he is anointed, it doesn't just mean that one day. It kind of means from the day he is anointed. So as soon as they're qualified and they're anointed with the oil, then it counts. So it's worth bearing that in mind.
The last passage of chapter 6, again, Jason, deals with the sin offering. And you're telling me we definitely don't get a male lamb in the sin offering. Is that what you're saying?
Sadly, no male lamb in the sin offering.
All right. Just checking.
Oh, so one other thing. When If a person brings an offering, a meal offering, then a portion of that is thrown on the fire and the priests get the rest. That's their allotted portion. But when a priest gives a meal offering, that all goes onto the altar. So there's no, you know, there's a loss. I mean, sometimes you could imagine that if that wasn't the case, the priest would be like, oh, you know, well, where's the cost to me? I can go and I can sacrifice this thing and then I can just take the stuff back again. But that's not the case with a meal offering. So if a priest gave a voluntary meal offering on the altar, the whole thing went on the altar. Mm-hmm. So there was a cost incurred for priests that wanted to give offerings and sacrifices as well.
Chapter 7 begins with the Torah, if you like, the Torah of the trespass offering. Ross, anything to highlight there?
Yeah, just kind of going back to something Jason said earlier when he made the point that not always when you read the word Torah does it refer to the five books of Moses. So it is with this idea, this phrase, when we say Holy of Holies, most English speakers think of the sanctum, the inner sanctuary, you know, that holiest place. But this phrase, Holy of Holies, occurs 25 times. And in this particular Torah portion, it occurs five times. And it's so it shows up throughout this particular section, actually beginning in chapter 6, but in chapter 7, verse 1.
Likewise, this is the law of the trespass offering. I've got here, it is most holy, but you're saying it's holy of holies, yeah?
Yep, in Hebrew, it's kodesh right. kodeshim, and it's the same in verse 6. So that's just another thing that people, you know, the translations vary, but in the Hebrew, that's the same phrase. So
the guilt offering itself... So the guilt offering usually, there's two instances of the guilt offering. There was a trespass offering where someone would have been busted. So you kind of admit your fault or you've been caught out and there's a penalty to that. And that was one reason for giving a guilt offering. The other one would have been where maybe you have to make a restitution for an injury. And then that part of the guilt offering would be offered up as well. But if we skip on a little bit, through to 10 in mine anyway, it says, and every meal offering mingled with oil or dry shall all the sons of Aaron have one as well as another. And when it says or dry, it literally means no oil. I know that this might sound like I'm teaching people to suck eggs, but I know my first tour through the Torah, I was super confused by some really silly things. And there's no such thing as a dumb question, so I thought that was worth mentioning. Mingled with oil or dry literally means no oil.
So another curious thing as we go forward into the peace offering is that we find a case where leavened bread is offered. In verse 13, it says, besides the cakes as his offering, and this is the peace offering, he shall offer leavened bread with the sacrifice of thanksgiving for his peace offering.
Yeah, but the leavened bread didn't make it to the altar, I think is what I remember reading
earlier
on.
That's right. That's
it's
right.
As a heave offering, it's waved before the Lord, I believe. Is that right, Ross?
Yeah. Jason's point is right. It's I think it's chapter 2, verse 11 says that it can't be on the altar. So
there's that. Now, that brings us to a very controversial verse, and that is, and only among some, but that's chapter 7, verse 15. And what it says is, the flesh of the sacrifice of his peace offering for thanksgiving shall not be eaten on the same day that it is offered. He shall not leave any of it until morning. With some scholars, the controversy is that the Jewish day is supposed to begin and traditionally and historically is in favor of a evening-to-evening reckoning of a calendar date. Mm-hmm. The little piece in question is where it says in verse 15, he shall not leave any of it until morning.
I know what you're talking about. I'm looking at it in the Hebrew, and it does say, and no, he shall leave of it, or to rest, literally, from it until boker, until morning.
So he shall eat of it that same day. None of it shall be left until morning. So the argument is that if it's on the same day, then shouldn't it be eaten prior to sundown, prior to the evening? But here we have a definition, what seems to be a definition of a calendar date extending to the morning. It shall be eaten on that same day. It shall be eaten before the sun rises.
Interesting. That's not the only instance of that in the Tanakh either.
No, no, it's not. It's not the only instance. This is one of those key verses.
That's the difficulty between tomorrow and the morning.
Tomorrow never comes. Tomorrow never comes.
Because if tomorrow actually means later on today, that gets confusing.
So it's interesting. It's just, we won't, I mean, we could spend a long time on that, but that's just one of those key verses that some historians will point to and say, you know, it wasn't always the case that it was evening to evening, and some believe that it was a calendar date was indeed reckoned from morning to morning. And an interesting thing about that, and I'll let the listeners do the homework, but it's with such a concept in mind, they have an interesting, how should I say, a chronology, if you like, of Pesach, which is coming up, of course. Mm-hmm. And as you highlighted, Russell, or was it Jason, that, of course, Pesach, it does sound like Pesach. Pesach is an evening meal, and none of the lamb is to be left until morning. It's to be burnt in the fire. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting. Just one of those things, something for listeners to ponder.
Off the top of my head, the instance with Lot's daughters throws up a similar kind of issue.
That's another one, but we can't go back into Genesis. But of course, you know.
People can go and read that through and draw down, like do a little map of what's happening and dates and times and see what you come up with. There's one other thing I want to put down for peace offerings. I made quite a nice note. Traditionally, there are three different types of peace offerings. It's divided into three divisions. There's a peace offering for Thanksgiving when you are delivered from sickness or danger, which I think technically we could call being saved or salvation. And I've got some examples here. So Psalm 107 is a good example of that. You can look that up. There's the fulfillment of a vow made in times of distress. I think everyone's done that. You know, if you just get me through this, I'll be the best person. And I'll be untouchable when it comes to mitzvahs. I'm going to give charity, just get me through it. So Psalm 116 is a good example of that. And a free will offering. So just when you are amazed at how great God is and you're grateful and you're thankful, Psalm 103 verses 1 through 5 are a really nice example of that. So traditionally, they're the three different types of peace offering.
Then we have the fat and the blood that may not be eaten. That's, emphasized a number of times, and it was, of course, in the last Torah portion. You shall not eat any fat of ox or sheep or goat. And the fat of the animal that dies naturally, the fat of the animal that dies naturally and the fat of what is torn by a wild beast may be used in any other way. How about that? It can be used in any way, but you shall by no means eat it. Whoever eats the fat of the animal which men offer an offering made by fire to the Lord, that person who eats it shall be cut off from his people. Moreover, you shall not eat any blood in any of your dwellings, whether bird or beast. Whoever eats any blood, that person shall be cut off from his people.
There's a couple of things there. Firstly, dieth of itself, dies naturally. Nevilah, I think, is the Hebrew term for that. Now, that doesn't just mean a goat you find in the field that's been ripped to pieces by a wolf. It also means if an animal doesn't get killed in a kosher manner. So if something goes wrong with the sacrifice or the slaughter, that animal also comes under that barrier. One other little caveat of this is that fish aren't mentioned. I mean, I have yet to find a fish that you could say has blood. They do, but it just doesn't work the same way as our blood.
It's not quite the same, is it?
No,
that's right.
So that's not included. You don't have to worry about kosher fish, except for the fins and scales.
Fins and the scales. Yeah. Okay, I'm just gonna say if I'm wandering through the field and I find a goat that's died naturally, I'm not doing anything with it, Ross.
Yeah, I was looking at the phrase "cut off from people," cut off from his people, and you know I did a study on that one time. There, this precise phrase, as it's worded here in the Hebrew in this verse in chapter 7, verse 20 and 21. It occurs six times in Scripture, but just if you go through, there are quite a few examples. Eating leaven in Exodus 12, working on the Shabbat in 31, the unclean approaching the holiness zones in Leviticus, touching a dead person in Numbers chapter 19. I mean, over and over, this idea of cut one off from his people. It sounds really, really lonely, doesn't it, to be cut off from your people?
I think that's a kind of death. I think if you're part of Israel and you're kicked out of the community, That's your livelihood, your house, your family, your friends, your relationship with God is not going to be altered because you can't go through the same techniques of relationship. You know, you've got no ritual items, you've got no priests. Then you're left completely on your own. I'd like to think that the message of the Tanakh says that this person could turn around and make a repentance call on this, and that they'd be accepted.
Well, we do see that, though, don't we? With I guess is it a good example to raise in regards to Miriam, who was cut off from the camp for a period of time?
Mm.
Yeah, I think even short periods of isolation are very troubling. And, you know, if you think about in Scripture, especially like in the very beginning in Genesis, it's the first thing that's considered not good is for man to be alone. Mm-hmm. So when I read that, you know, I know people vary on their understanding of what it means to be cut off from their people, whether it's temporary, whatever. But the idea of being separated from your people, to Jason's point, is something that's really, really bad when you're talking about a communal system.
Absolutely. The final passage of chapter 7 deals with the portion for Aaron and his sons. Jason, anything you want to highlight there?
Yeah, I think you mentioned earlier the heave offering. And I've got to admit, I went through this for nearly a year, and I didn't understand what a heave offering was. I mean, I'd never read anywhere that it means to set it apart for a different purpose. You know, so I think it's quite important that a wave offering was literally waved, and a heave offering was picked up and used for something else. So that they're two definitions that are
a good point. So what is the, Ross, what is the difference between waving and heaving? I mean, it's a little bit... Is that, how do you understand it?
Well, I think in Hebrew, the word literally is wave, but to Jason's point, it's literally something that's elevated.
No, but that's because I do have in some verses here, it says as a heave offering. And here in this passage here, I've got verse 30, it says the fat of the breast he shall bring, that the breast may be waved as a wave offering before the Lord. Jason, do you have any idea what the difference is between a wave and a heave offering?
Yeah, they take the fat of the breast. Now, this is the person that's making the offering. So usually in these instances, you would bring your item, your animal, and you'd literally give that to the priest. He'd then slaughter the animal, and they'd do everything else. But in this instance, the person that's bringing it keeps it in his hand, and the priest would come, and he'd put his hand under the guy that's making the offering, and he'd guide the offerer's hand. And it would go forward and backwards, and then it would go upwards and downwards. And it would basically, it's a symbolic gesture to consecrate that, to lift that up to God, the ruler of heaven and earth. That's what I've got in my notes. That was the wave offering. It literally got waved.
Well, yeah, because in verse 32, it says, also the right thigh you shall give to the priest as a heave offering for the sacrifices. So there's definitely a difference. So what happens with the heave offering?
The heave offering was literally separated, and I think that went to the priest for food. The right thigh traditionally in an animal, the left thigh and the right thigh, but the thighs had the best meat. So that was the most expensive and the nicest part. And from my notes, anyway, it seems that heaved part was set apart, and the priest got to eat that.
Okay.
There's one other thing about this particular, what we would call the priest's due. You know, what goes to the priest? Here in Leviticus chapter 7, what does it say that the priest gets? Verse 34, for I've taken the breast of elevation offering and the thigh of gift offering from the Israelites from their sacrifices of well-being and given them to Aaron the priest and to his sons as their due from the Israelites for all time. So here you have the breast and the thigh, whereas if you go to Deuteronomy chapter 18, verse 3, look at that. It's a little bit different.
Okay, so it says, and this shall be the priest's due from the people, from those who offer a sacrifice, whether it is a bull or sheep, they shall give it to the priest, the shoulder, the cheeks, and the stomach. The stomach?
Yeah, that's like a nice gift. But anyway, I was... when I
it's
think
an
about
awful
that,
gift.
Yeah. Here's
a haggis.
Here's your shoulder, two cheeks, and a stomach. Thank you very
and
much.
A haggis.
But the one of the study notes, I think I saw it in the Jewish Study Bible, said that the rabbis say that Deuteronomy 18 is non-sacrificial sacrificial meat, used for food.
Okay, Jason.
No.
Did you want to say something about awful, Jason?
No, I was so happy with my joke. I had to type it down as well. I've been hanging on to that joke for 4 years, yeah. And finally, I got to say it was an awful gift. There we are. Where are we up to now?
So I just want to read this bit. So this is from verse 35. This is the consecrated portion for Aaron and his sons from the offering made by fire to the Lord on the day when Moses presented them as minister to the Lord as priests. Now, before I go on, that brings me to a comment by Sophie. G'day, Sophie. Sophie, the truth to you comment queen. The comment that she left last time you and I spoke, Ross, in a Torah portion not so long ago, and she was just furthering what she had said in regards to the word priest, the topic of Kohanim. Kohen could be translated more as, quote, minister than, quote, priest or ruler. Thus, it makes more sense from an English perspective than the more common translation of priest. Think of a government minister, for example, a, quote, prime minister, and also a religious minister. The word Kohen is derived from the root verb kahane, which means to serve, hence its application to serve in a religious or government capacity. And she cited, now, Ross, because you brought up the fact, I think it was 2 Samuel 8:18,
That's right. That was the verse that I brought up, yeah.
That was David's sons serving as Sophie would say is serving as ministers, a position of service. But she also highlights 1 Kings chapter 4, verse 5 as another example, which I found interesting, and this is what it says, and this is Solomon's administration. It says, Azariah, the son of Natan, over the officers, Nabud, the son of Natan, a priest and the king's friend. But here, the priest is in reference to as an appointment of personal staff, a special advisor, if you like. And so in a governmental sense, the word priest is applied. So I just thought I'd throw that into the mix. Thank you, Sophie, for that comment. But it does go on to say, here in Leviticus chapter 36, now I'm after the Lord commanded this to be given to them, the children of Israel, on the day that he anointed them by a statute forever throughout that generations. This is the law of the burnt offering, of the grain offering, the sin offering, the trespass offering, the consecrations, and the sacrifice of the peace offering, which the Lord commanded Moses on Sinai. On that day, when he commanded the children of Israel to offer their offerings to the Lord in the wilderness of Sinai, we're here at chapter 8.
One thing before you go to chapter 8.
I was going to do that too.
Okay, let's go.
So you talk about the anointing of the priest. Here I'm taking Kohen as priest. One thing that I like to point out to people, last week's Torah portion, I hate to go back, but just to bring this up, you know, the phrase, the word HaMashiach, you know, Mashiach means the anointed one, HaMashiach, the anointed one. Mm. That particular, in that form, is only used four times in all of the Torah, all of which occur in Leviticus, all of which occur in last week's Torah portion, and every time it is associated with the Kohen. So it says the anointed one, the priest, the anointed one, HaKohen HaMashiach. So anyway, I just thought that's interesting, because it's the priest in the Torah that's always the one that's anointed, never anyone else.
And specifically, speaking, of course, of the Aaronic priesthood. Specifically, Jason.
I think that phrase, HaKohen HaMashiach, only occurs four times. I'm really going off the top of my head now.
That's right.
And I think each of the four times only applies to Aaron when we read it in the text.
Is it specifically to Aaron, or is it specifically to Aaron's office?
I think possibly to Aaron's office, but only for the position of high priest. So if we're looking in the, and really this usually only comes up if I'm having kind of a chat with a Hebrew roots person, but they will say that a certain person in the Bible, in the Christian Bible, is HaKodesh HaMashiach, meaning Jesus. But when I ask them where they get that information from, the only person that could be a reference to in the text if we're going to pull off one name is Aaron, because it's the only person who is mentioned in conjunction with that phrase. And as we know, Aaron was a flesh and blood person and he died. So there's nothing kind of, he wasn't a king even. It's a completely, wrong title for someone that's going to be this King Messiah. It just doesn't work out. But what I wanted to get to very quickly was in verse 37, the word consecration. I mean, we see consecrate a lot in consecration. Most of us who come from a Christian background, or if we're a fan of the Highlander film, we'll be like, you know, consecrated ground, Highlander. But what does consecrate really mean? You know, it's normally it's blessed. And in this instance, the Hebrew for this word literally means filling. So it's if it's consecrated, it's been kind of, if you like, painted with a reason or a meaning for its being. To the point that we'll also see sometimes the phrase to fill the hand. And that's an idiom for when a person is appointed to an office. So when a person is anointed as a priest, they now have this new office, and they have been consecrated, they've been set apart, but more importantly, they've been given a reason. They're now imbued with a purpose. And I think that just in the same way that holy ground is consecrated for a purpose, people are also consecrated for a purpose.
Yeah, one other point, when you talk about this ceremony associated with the priesthood that really is covered in chapter 8, verses 6 through 30, it's a replay, if you will, of Exodus chapter 29, but it's actually taking place here, whereas 29 described it. And the footnote in the Jewish Study Bible says that the ceremony of induction into the priesthood consists of five elements. They're mm-hmm. clothed, there's an invocation or an offering, they're consecrated, there is a filling of the hands, and then there's anointing. So those are the five phases associated with becoming a priest. And back to the point about HaKohen HaMashiach, those four verses, just so people have them in their notes, it's Leviticus chapter 4, verse 3, Leviticus 4, verse 5, Leviticus 4, verse 16, and Leviticus 6, 15. In English, that last one would be chapter 6, verse 22, because of the differences.
Right. The differences.
Yep.
Within it, there's a really curious, I've never been able to, I mean, there must be some sort of explanation for this, but verse 23 says that he took some of the blood, and this is within the ceremony of consecrating Aaron and his sons, he took some of the blood and put it on the tip of Aaron's right ear, on the thumb of his right hand, and on the big toe of his right foot. Any idea, Jason?
I read...
Hang on, who's flushing a toilet?
Not me. That's the sink in the kitchen occasionally gurgles.
You're talking to us from the bathroom, aren't you?
No, yeah. That only happens at night time. It's very weird.
It totally sounded like a toilet then.
It did.
Can you still hear it gurgling?
I can hear it gurgling away.
Oh, wow.
That's funny. Yeah. That's all right. Any idea?
There is a tradition that the ear is touched, so that everything he hears will be he'll have a holy opinion of it. The ear, the thumb, yeah, everything he hears, everything he does, and everywhere he goes, he'll remember the holiness of his office. That's one of the traditions I read.
Yeah, I have something to add. This is from the Hertz Pentateuch. Rabbi Hertz's comment says, ear, hand, foot are symbolic, representing consecration of the entire body. The priest must have consecrated ears, ever to be attentive to the commands of God, consecrated hands at all times to do his will, and consecrated feet evermore to walk in his holy ways.
Oh, that's good.
Interesting.
Yep.
That'll do. I think that's, yeah, very interesting. Nice. Thank you for that. Is there anything else we want to highlight from chapter 8, Ross?
Yes. One thing in verses 31 through 36, after this ceremony, the priests are to wait 8 days. And it's interesting the way we do the Torah readings, because once we complete this, we also will not resume the story until the 8th day. And that particular Torah portion is called Shmoni, which is dealing with the 8th day. It begins immediately. Mm-hmm. So I always think that's pretty interesting. Speaking of eight, guess what is significant about Leviticus chapter 8, verse 8 in this week's Torah portion. You can
Okay, well, let me read it. I'll read it out. It says, then he put the breastplate on him, and he put the Urim and the Tumim in the breastplate.
That's okay. All right. What? So if you read in the Masoretic notes, you know, the scribes in Hebrew are called Sofrim, those who count. And this verse is marked by the scribes as the center verse in all the Torah. So we're already dealing with Leviticus is the center of the Torah as far as the books go. This particular Torah portion has the center verse. So mark that in your Bibles, Leviticus chapter 8, verse 8.
Does that mean we're halfway through Torah pills?
Well, if you're talking about verse counts, you're exactly halfway when you reach Leviticus 8:8.
There it is. All right. Thanks for that. That's curious. I didn't know that. Jason.
One other thing that is kind of interesting is chapter 8 starts off and it says that the whole of the assembly of Israel was brought to the tent, the gateway to the tent of meeting. So you have to, I mean, that's a lot of people, right? I mean, I've read a few different, some people, there's an idea that it was just the head of the clans, or it was, you know, because Israel was basically divided up into groups of men, and they were governed by one man, and those groups were governed by one man. So it's easier to govern and manage. And it maybe it wasn't all of Israel who were there; it was just the heads, the elders, if you like, or the judges, or that there was some sort of stepping rock that they could see. But whatever way you look at it, for the whole of the congregation of Israel to have been there and to have listened and heard, it must have been an awesome spectacle. Because you've got millions of people, and there's the one tiny little area that they're all trying to focus on. It must have been very annoying for the short guy at the back.
Fair enough. Listen, that is it. That is our Torah portion. That's Sar from Leviticus 7, 8, and 9. Next week is Shmini, where unfortunately...
Wait a minute. Shmini isn't until April the 18th because of Passover, two consecutive weeks where there's a special Torah portion. And here's the deal. If you happen to need someone else... See, this week we talked about the center verse. If I were to come back, if not, the deal is off. But if I were to come back for the next one, I can tell you the center word and the center letter, because both of those occur in Shmini. But if I don't, give it up. I'm not going to tell you.
We may have to do that. Thank you, Russ Nichols. Russ Nichols of rootsoffaith.org, rootsoffaith.org. Jason of spiritualbabies.net, spiritualbabies.net. Oh, my goodness. Thank you, guys. I look forward to speaking to you again. That has been Torah Pearls. You can join us in the land in November, dear friends. We would love to have you with us. If you would like to join us on the Israel tour, the Tanakh tour, go to truthtoyou.org and just follow the links. There is still seats available. Until next week, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.